name's Brenda Marston. I'm from the U.S., the Cornell University in New York, and I'm glad to be chairing this session, which is part of the series Centering Recovering Lesbian Histories and Memories. And you should all know that it was these four people that came up with that idea, and the conference organizers thought it was such a good thing, they made a whole stream on that topic. So I'm going to keep my comments minimal so that we have time to listen to the speakers and you have time to have a conversation, and I'll introduce each one as we go. So their first speaker is Tuna Hellesund, a professor of cultural studies at the University of Bergen, Norway. She's done research on spinsters from 1880 to 1940, on modern homosexual suicide narratives, and on people living outside conventional families in contemporary Europe. She's heavily involved with the Norwegian Queer Archive. And her paper is Desexualizing Lesbians, Strategic and Ideological Positionings in Norwegian Radical Feminist Periodicals, 1976 to 1986.
Thank you so much, Brenda. And thank you all for coming to this session. And like Brenda said, I'm affiliated with the Norwegian Queer Archive, and we have a lot of different material, of course, a lot of about 200 oral interviews, a lot of private archives, a lot of organizational archives, and we also have a lot of periodicals. And actually, when we started to look into this, and queer history is so new in Norway, that we were just amazed that we found more than 50 Norwegian periodicals, queer Norwegian periodicals. And I have been looking into the lesbian radical feminist periodicals from the 1970s and 1980s. This is one of them, called the Lavender Express, Lavendel Expressen, a great magazine. And here are three of the other ones, Amazonen, Lesbisk Internavis, and Lesbiske Feminister. So all these journals, and they didn't come in large numbers or for long periods of time, but I think they represent really important part of the queer history and provide a lot of interesting discussions from the time. So in 1975, a group of lesbian feminists in Oslo decided that it was too hard to do lesbian politics in the new feminist organizations, and also too hard to do feminist work in the main homophile organization called DNF48. So to secure lesbian visibility and a safe space for lesbians, they founded the lesbian movement, Lesbisk Bevegelse, it was called in Norway. And my start-out question when reading these periodicals, the periodicals of these organizations, was, how did they relate to sex and desire? That was my interest, and that's what I have been looking for when reading these magazines. And same-sex sexual desire is one definition of lesbianism. This was, however, not the definition used by the lesbian radical feminists. And a highly influential manifesto, The Woman Identified Woman, written by the US radical lesbians in 1970, was translated to Norwegian and appears to have been an important document. This document's core argument was that women must free themselves from patriarchy by relating to one another instead of relating to men. And the content of this manifesto was echoed in the definition of lesbianism that was published in the first issue of the periodical Lavendel Expressen. Yeah, here you see the title of the, or the manifesto, the first page of the manifesto. And here is the definition in Lavendel Expressen. As lesbians, we are in a different situation than heterosexual women. We are not in the same way dependent on men, socially, sexually, and economically, which gives us the experiences that the women's movement needs. If women hadn't started to relate to each other independently of men, and if we hadn't loved each other, regardless of sexual preferences, then there presumably hadn't been a women's movement at all. Lesbianism is an alternative for all women. So their focus was on lesbians as woman-identified women, not on sexuality. And it was lesbianism for women who loved other women, regardless of sexual preference. And one of the strongest undercurrents in the periodicals in regard to sex is the fundamental difference in the portrayals of male and female sexuality. In one of their columns called My First Love, we find one of the explicit descriptions of the differences between male and female sexuality. So here is from the story. My first love. Suddenly she held me tight, both with her hands and her gaze. Soft fingers against my ribs. Her heart beat so wildly that my own heart changed its beat and followed hers. None of us moved. This was no game. This, exactly this, I will never experience again, I thought. This is the first time. It will never be exactly the same again. Then I flung myself on her and made love to her. Not tender and lovingly like a woman, but more like a James Bond, Morgan Cain imitation. Later she told me otherwise. I grew up a little then. Became brave enough to admit that even rock-hard me could feel. That's what she taught me. A woman was what was needed. So sexual desire is unmistakably present in this story. And also the norms for how this desire should play out are clearly described. Love, softness, feelings, and tenderness are good qualities. Hardness and active physical moves, like flinging oneself onto someone and making love to them, are approaches that lesbians should seek to liberate themselves from. The discourse established in these periodicals is one of women being focused on intimacy and emotional closeness, and men as disconnected and incapable of intimacy. The presumption was that only in a lesbian relationship could women be free from the warped understanding of sex and sexuality in patriarchal society. Lesbianism became the highest form of love, and heterosexuality the ultimate sign of female masochism. Yeah, so here you see some of the words used for male versus female sexuality. And the interesting thing is, of course, that, or one of the interesting things is, of course, that these periodicals use a lot more space on male sexuality than on female sexuality. Here is also an example of male sexuality. While the magazines give a pretty clear picture of how male sexuality is perceived, the perception of female sexuality is far more elusive. It seems to have been very difficult for members of the lesbian movement to speak and write explicitly about sex, sexual experiences, and desires. Apart from qualities like soft, tender, nurturing, love-based, and holistic, descriptions of lesbian desire and sex are less extensive and far less detailed than descriptions of male sexuality. In the second issue of Lavendelexpressen, we find a call for texts on lesbian sexuality. And in this call, they ask their readers to send in texts because sex is something we rarely talk about. Unfortunately, and maybe characteristically, none of the readers responded to this call. So they did not get the special issue on sex. It was hard for lesbian radical feminists to navigate in the landscape of genital sex. What were good and legitimate feminist desires? Was a wish for orgasms, was that patriarchal? Or was a focus on orgasms disconnected, competitive, and too focused on specific body parts? Was flinging oneself onto a lover male? The credo of the time claimed that sex and sexual liberation was universally important. The Norwegian lesbian radical feminists did not deny this, and they half-heartedly tried to write about sex. However, it seems to have been of primary importance that the focus on sex should not take precedence over what was seen as far more important than genital pleasure, to be authentic and intimate with another human being, to communicate, to love, and be loved as a whole person. So while sexual desire was potentially problematic in this context. Emotional desire was seen as natural and good. The lesbian radical feminist movement of the 1970s and 1980s was deeply connected to other contemporary social movements and major cultural shifts that occurred at the time. One such shift was the cultural move towards an ethics of authenticity and a moral obligation to be true to oneself. The 1970 manifesto of the US Radical Lesbians carries numerous references to authenticity. The opening paragraph states that a lesbian is a woman who, often beginning at an extremely early age, acts in accordance with her inner compulsion to be a more complete and freer human being. So this complete and free human being coming from within is the authentic self. And here is also from the manifest. It is the primacy of women relating to women, of women creating a new consciousness of and with each other, which is at the heart of women's liberation and a basis for the cultural revolution. Together we must find, reinforce, and validate our authentic selves. The Norwegian periodicals expressed the same longing through their focus on completeness and on living lives that allowed all parts of themselves to be present at all times. Beneath their destructive femininity, they believed in the existence of an authentic one, a self unspoiled by societal values and norms, a self that could only be found outside of heterosexual relations. And to find the true and authentic forces within oneself and one another, one had to be prepared to work hard on soul-searching, honesty, disclosure, and communication. A discourse which is both parallel and integral to the discourse of authenticity is what we can call the discourse or the ethics of intimacy. And sociologist Lynn Jameson names a particular ethics of intimacy for disclosing intimacy. It is a form of intimacy that emphasizes mutual disclosure, constantly revealing your inner thoughts and feelings to each other. It is an intimacy of the self rather than an intimacy of the body. And a pure relationship or disclosing intimacy appears as a discourse from the 1960s and onwards in the West. And the language of equality, rather than the former focus on gender complementarity, emerges. The ideal typical marriage now began to be described as something similar to disclosing intimacy. At the heart of this discourse is a longing to be known. So where the romantic lover sought mystery and to remain mysterious, the lover under intimacy wants to break through deception to a true meeting of minds. Intimacy and authentic feminist sex was, or it had to be, very different from the competitiveness, the focus on performance and achievement, and the disconnected body parts they saw as the patriarchal approach to sex. And in this process, the chase for orgasms and genital sex could be seen as the opposite of the quest for true authenticity. So the lesbian radical feminists in Norway did not write or reflect extensively on sex and sexuality in their periodicals. There were probably many reasons for this downplaying of sex, but my main argument here, however, is that sex was downplayed also because it conflicted with some of the main underlying foci of the movement, namely authenticity and intimacy. And while authenticity and intimacy were constructed as preferable companions to sex in the New Left and in many other parts of the feminist movement, the Norwegian lesbian radical feminists seemed to construct authenticity and intimacy in opposition to genital sex. Changes in gender relations and the appearance of same-sex relationships have pushed towards more egalitarian forms of relationships and creative life experiments since the 1970s. Love and sexuality have become highly reflective arenas, and an ethics of authenticity and intimacy has become central to hetero as well as homo relationships. The Norwegian lesbian radical feminist of the 1970s and 1980s was a part of this shift. In their fight against patriarchy and their exploration of female identity and sisterhood, in their refusal to be objects or patriarchal, lustful and objectifying subjects, lesbian radical feminists in Norway did not create a wide open space for discussions of lesbian sexual desire. They did, however, participate in creating a new discourse where authenticity and intimacy were seen as the most important components of human relationships. Thank you.
Thank you. And next is Ulla Mans, a historian of ideas and a professor of gender studies at Södertörn University, Sweden. She's written extensively about the history of the early organized women's movement and historiography, as well as about the rise and development of women's and gender studies in Nordic countries. And the talk's titled Unlegibility and Visibility, The Risk of Unqueering 19th Century Feminism.
Thank you, and hi everybody. Let's do some technical things here, if I manage to. No, I did not. No. Yes. 19th century photos are usually not a good quality, and since it's quite light in here, they will be... It will be difficult to see them. I'm sorry for that. Okay. Is this any way... do you see anything at all? Okay, because I don't see anything. Okay. No. Oh, this is much better. Okay. That's why I seldom use PowerPoints, because I'm a 19th century historian. And you will see why. Anyway, thank you for coming and listening to our session here. This presentation is based on a recently published article of mine that I published in an edited volume devoted to same-sex sexuality and female couples in the Swedish early women's movement. It's in Swedish, but any of you who know some Scandinavian languages can have a look at it and also look at the photos here. There are quite nice photos in here as well. There were, in fact, quite a lot of female couples in the Swedish early organized women's movement. So my article concerns questions about visibility and legibility of same-sex relations and non-heteronormative lives in historical public sources, not in private archives, letters, diaries, and so on, but actually in public sources like articles and monographs and pamphlets and so on. As well as how you can see and not see traces of same-sex relations in the historiography of the early women's movement. The article is part of a larger study I conduct about the cultural memory of Western 19th century feminism and its memory politics. And today, I will specifically address the risk of unqueering, to use the word from my colleague Dagmar Bruno, in 19th century feminism. The Dutch scholar Maria Schrever has stressed the importance of studying memory production in feminism, something I really agree with. How the women's movement tells its own story, how commemorations, jubilees, and other collective memories are organized and materialized, show not least how feminist identities were produced and thought of at the time. Studies of cultural memories also show future visions and feminist ideals within the very time when they are produced, not least concerning womanhood and social change. And Maria Schrever writes, Maria Schrever writes, and here I quote, a study about feminist memory production calls attention to how these memories define a feminist identity and consequently why certain women did not earn a place in the pantheon of feminist culture. By and large, I do agree with this statement. Memory production certainly creates a kind of pantheon where certain ideas, persons, ways of living, and occasions are remembered and talked about, but also some are not. These memories, they are selected and narrated, they need to be contextualized. They need to be read and analyzed in their own, in their proper historical, spatio-temporal context. We repeatedly have to ask ourselves, what was possible to say and make visible at that particular time, in a particular cultural and political context? And furthermore, studying cultural memory also forces us to ponder upon how different memories could have been read back then as well. This is a photo I will comment upon later on. You can just look at it. When it comes to same-sex sexuality, contextualization of public records is necessary in order not to unqueer 19th century queer lives and thoughts, even if they are not particularly visible in the source material and therefore not easy for a reader of today to see. Queer people, feelings, and relations are seldom explicit in historical source material from the women's movement. And yet they are there. But we can't expect that collective or cultural memories will make visible the existence of feminists living outside of heterosexuality. Because we all know that one of the most common caricatures of a feminist back then was one of an unfeminine woman, a manly, probably also man-hating spinster, not seldom portrayed as a lesbian. And in my article in this book, I start a discussion about reading practices, and I address particularly gender historians, historians of the early women's movement. In at least Nordic scholarship about the women's movement, you can see a notable gap between two fields of knowledge about early feminism. One is the knowledge production about early feminist organizations and campaigns, and the other one is about the many female couples and lesbian women back then. These two fields of knowledge are not yet integrated. It seems like historians, much less than literary scholars, have tried to interpret and analyze the women's movement in the context of expected heterosexuality. And even though gender historians have for long known about these same-sex couples in the movement, nothing has really happened. Extremely few queer readings in one way or another have been done on historical public sources. And I argue in this article that we can contextualize feminist debates and discussions, not least about femininity, womanhood, proper conduct, and labor, in the light of heteronormativity of that time. So what would happen if we read our sources with a deliberate ambition to distance ourselves from a heterocentric reading that so far has dominated at least Swedish scholarship about the early women's movement? And in my article, I provide some examples how you can actually try to see things in a different perspective, that a queer-inspired reading can open up for new interpretations about same-sex sexuality, womanhood, and feminism. And I've done this particularly with inspiration from queer and literary scholar Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick, her discussion about reparative readings. Very briefly, a reading that strives to avoid the pitfalls of only finding what you already expect to be there. And I have also reminded myself to keep in mind that I can't expect explicit representations of non-heterosexuality in the sources, which is quite important when you read about things that doesn't relate to sexuality at all. It can be about suffrage or whatever. And also, I have for long been inspired by scholars who stresses the importance of paying attention to small remarks, short comments, that are made in text but not elaborated, yet they are there in plain sight. Not least, Joan Scott has stressed this, but also a recent study by literary scholar Sam Holmqvist in Sweden has convincingly shown how fruitful this kind of surface reading is in their study of transfigurations in 19th century fiction. And also Tone Hellesund's work that was mentioned in the beginning of this session about the spinster is extremely important to have in mind, that the spinster also included the lesbian. So since time is short, I will go on to my two examples. This is Alexandra Gripenberg, a quite known feminist from Finland, a Swedish Finnish. She was a baroness. She was very central in the International Women's Movement, International Council of Women. In 1903, she published the last volume of her three-volume monograph called, in English, it's written in Swedish, Reform Work for the Improvement of Women. And Gripenberg was a fierce opponent of all sorts of feminist motherhood rhetoric. She had for long been a strong opponent to the writings and ideas of the very influential Swedish famous feminist that was also very popular in Germany, Ellen Key, or perhaps Ellen Key, you pronounce it. But anyway, it's Ellen Key, whose ideas of women as first and foremost mothers, no matter biological motherhood or societal motherhood, Gripenberg deeply disliked. Women, according to Gripenberg, were to be seen and to be given rights and opportunities first and foremost as single individuals, not as gendered creatures. And this is something that in the historiography of the women's movement is often analyzed in the notions of, or the using the concept difference and equality. But you can actually see this whole discussion from another perspective. So throughout these three volumes, Gripenberg is consistent in her way of discussing gender inequalities and obstacles to emancipation. It is striking how Gripenberg avoids arguing in terms of biology and innate maternity. What we have to keep in mind in this is that this is very rare at the time, because motherhood rhetoric almost held a hegemonic position in not only in Nordic countries, but in much European feminism, I'd say. And then we have to ask ourselves, what can this absence of motherhood rhetoric mean in its special temporal context? And what happens when we take the heteronormativity of the time into account? As you all know, Ellen Key's ideas were deeply rooted and elaborated within a heteronormative framework. And Gripenberg doesn't seem to be grounded in that rhetoric. So I argue in this article that we're not arguing in terms of an innate motherhood or motherliness in every woman. Gripenberg doesn't determine women to a life within marriage or childbearing and rearing, that is, in a relation to a man. So what does this way of arguing and discussing women's emancipation mean from the perspective of collective memory and feminist identification that these three volumes produced? Well, if we go back to Maria Schrever, we can once again ask, who earns a place in the pantheon of feminist culture when you look at Gripenberg's monograph? Who could identify as a feminist reading Gripenberg? Well, definitely the ones that didn't choose motherhood, I'd say. So regardless of Gripenberg's own intentions, because that's not in focus here, it's actually the way it could have been read, I contend that the text, because of its way of arguing, make possible an identification for women to feel included, even if they did not belong to the category of women who intended to or even wanted to get married and start a family. So women outside of expected heteronormative conduct and life cycle could actually find identification markers in Gripenberg's text because of the absence of motherhood rhetoric. The category of the unmarried woman was not portrayed or discussed as an anomaly, an abnormal creature or somebody left over, the sad and lonely spinster. Now I look at Tone and your work. So I go on to the next, my next example, and it's a not totally different example, but just to give you some hint of how I argue. And my example is called paying attention to details in its heteronormative context and do surface reading. This is Ellen Klemann. She was for about 30 years the editor of the Fredrika Bremer Association's journal. It was the largest association in the women's movement in Sweden. She was also a lifelong partner with Clara Johansson, who was a famous writer and journalist. And they lived together, 30 or 40 years or so. And when they met, Clara Johansson gave Ellen Klemann the nickname Choice. And there's a beautiful article about them in that book that I have not written. In 1909, Ellen Klemann wrote a review of Ellen Key's latest throw-up, I would say, on the women's movement. It's called The Women's Movement. It's published 1909. The review is very short, but interesting. Ellen Key's critique against the women's movement and its feminist vision was not new at all. She had delivered that for 10 or 15 years ago, repeatedly. But anyway, it was harsh and unfair as usual, according to Ellen Klemann. In a short comment, the review is only 2 pages long, and it contains a comment on Ellen Key's critique of the women's movement, but it also contains a short discussion about the feminist vision that Ellen Key produces in her book. In particular, Klemann reacted to the exclusion of the unmarried woman in Ellen Key's feminism, and she asked, did not Ellen Key consider unmarried women to have the potential to become full-fledged persons or citizens because they chose not to marry? And she asks, where is the place for unmarried women, the ones without children, in the maternalistic vision of Ellen Key? The unmarried woman is not mentioned at all in Ellen Key's future ideal state, yet statistics show that she exists. So what Ellen Klemann asks in a rhetorical manner is, do we not belong to Ellen Key's vision? Feminist vision. Are we not counted as women or as feminists? In the context of sexual politics of the 20th century and with the knowledge of Ellen Klemann herself living outside of heterosexuality, the passage just quoted is easy to read as an opposition not only to the deterministic feminist vision of Ellen Key in general, that is to exclude all unmarried women, but also as an opposition to the heteronormativity of Ellen Key. And again, it's not spelled out. Instead, same-sex sexuality is implicitly referred to in discussions about unmarried women. So, before I conclude, I will comment upon this picture or photo. This is a photo found in Ellen Klemann, the one who wrote the review, she doesn't have an own private archive. It's integrated into Clara Johansson's private archive. And there are some photos in that archive, and most of them are shot by Ellen Klemann herself. And I found that photo in that archive. And we don't know who they are, these women, and we don't know actually if it's Ellen Klemann who took the photo or not. But if you look at the body language of these women and look at the wall with all the, it's all female, it's so woman-identified women here. And you can see the body language of how they're sitting. I'm just using that photo to make my argument stronger that you have to just, sometimes things are there at the surface. I love this photo. Well, so let's go back to the existing gap in the research and historiography about the early women's movement. It's not far-fetched to assume that a reader back then could read, identify, and also feel included as a lesbian, or if you prefer to call it a woman loving and living with other women outside of heterosexual marriage. in different texts produced by the movement itself, if the texts are read in the context of expected heterosexual life and desire. It seems like the problem of fully grasping the character of the feminist space that the turn of the century... It seems like the problem of fully grasping the character of the feminist space at the turn of the 20th century is a problem that we today have. Much history about the early women's movement, at least in Sweden, lack a capability to read between the lines and see subtle utterances, queer leakages, as well as oppositions and short remarks that are there in plain sight in public documents. So I argue that the more careful contextualization, not only of private archival sources, but also of public documents, will help us to see both see and read more nuanced. And this, I believe, will help us to study the memory politics of the 19th century feminism in all its complexity. Thank you.
Now we're jumping back to the 1980s for the next talk from Elisabeth Lund Engebretsen, Associate Professor at the Network for Gender Studies, University of Stavanger, Norway. An anthropologist, Elisabeth, researches gender and sexual diversity in transnational contexts, especially in China and the Nordic region. Among other publications, she is the author of Queer Women in Urban China and Ethnography from 2014, and last year she co-edited the special issue Anthropology's Queer Sensibilities in Sexualities. This talk is titled Tense Alliances, Gender Politics in Norway's Gay and Lesbian Periodicals During the Transitional 1980s.
Thank you so much. I should say, compared with the two very wonderful, sophisticated analytical papers you've heard so far, mine is a very... early paper on a topic or a research project that I'm just starting or started out in January this year. So this is more like a teaser for the next ALMS conference, where I will hopefully be able to present data material and analysis as well. So it's an unfolding project, and I will basically introduce you to it and give you a little bit of data, snippets of data, and thoughts on the future directions of it. The broader project is both part of a Nordic or Scandinavian research group that I won't talk about, because you can hear all about it on Saturday, where Peter Edelberg and Signe Gagnesjø Bremer will actually introduce the full project, A Nordic Queer Revolution, the Formation of Gay, Queer and Trans Activism in Scandinavia between 1948 and 2018. I'll talk a little bit about my own work package here instead. The title is Beyond Equality, Women's Sexual Justice Politics in Scandinavian Queer Organizing. It examines the history of women's participation in Scandinavian queer or LGBTQ plus movements, with a particular focus on the period since the late 1970s. The project is at once an oral history of queer women's life strategies in the developing Scandinavian welfare and so-called women-friendly societies of the time. It's a mapping of movements and a critical study of collective activism. The goal for me is to write a broader historical account of a community, its activism and culture, and not merely compile a text of personal narratives. Both personal voices, but also a sense of community culture, is so far missing from the queer history, or largely missing from the queer history in Norway. And I think it's important to contribute to developing an understanding of a culture of resistance from sexual gender minorities in modern Norway, and how it's shaped and was shaped by broader trends in the queer community movement, feminism, as well as general society. And this is also connected to larger political and economic changes at the time. So do we really need more empirical studies of queer history? Do we need to know more about Norway? Why is Norway important at all? I think that within the remit of queering memory, I think this kind of project is important in Norway because, as Tone mentioned, there is hardly any queer history research being done in the country. We don't really have a lasting research community. There's no collective research environment for ongoing critical gender and queer research. And while we do have a queer archive in Bergen, it is not primarily a research institution in and of itself. So basically, there needs to be more research done for this reason. And also by locating the study in what is widely recognized as one of the world's most egalitarian and sort of equal regions, where queer organizing long has worked very closely with the state and been supported by it, especially by receiving a lot of funding. I'm interested in exploring these connections and I think also tensions, at least latent ones, in the context of state politics of gender equality and welfare society that we sort of still to this day seem to be exporting around the world for everyone else to follow. Why is there so much, so little visibility and knowledge of the queer pasts, for example, or within this paradigm? So in this sense, my project aims to queer the recent memory of the superior claim to a superior Norwegian gender equality and welfare state. Some of my central questions, just to give you an idea, what collective identities did women adapt and at which times? When and why were commonalities and or differences emphasized in these identity projects and activist projects? What forms of collective organizing did they establish and what were their aims? How did women relate to other forms of activism, including mixed gender organizing within and beyond queer community? What differences and similarities can we find throughout the Scandinavian region, and in which transnational circuits of political struggle and cultural politics did they partake? So the focus for me is less on the voices, persons, and politics that we already know about here, so in terms of recruiting informants and speaking to people, especially the strand, the well-known strand of lesbian feminist politics that has maintained a dominant position in much activism in Norway. I'm seeking out initiatives and individuals who stayed more in the periphery of the key struggles and politics at the time. I'm interested in the everyday lives of women and some of the men who became part of counter-movements within the broader mainstreaming of Norwegian lesbian and gay activism at the time, and especially mid-80s to throughout the 90s I'm focusing on. The 80s, I think, is a significant period for the movement. One factor has to do with the way that the HIV/AIDS epidemic unfolded and tensions within the movement regarding activist tactics and dominant male voices. It was also a period where tensions within the movement eventually consolidated into a regrouping and coming together of various fractions of interest groups in 1992 under the national umbrella of LLH, the National Organization for Lesbian and Gay Liberation, which was sort of the new version of the former DNF-48 that Tone was talking about. So it was a kind of a rebranding of the old organization. From a more general perspective, the 1980s was a formative period for Norwegian equality and welfare politics and the branding, as I mentioned, of Nordic gender equality. I'm interested in interrogating how women who were part of alternative lesbian and queer activist initiatives at this time, how they experienced this period also outside of being part of specific movements or groups, and how this impacted on their lives in relation to movement practices specifically, but just as much in their daily lives outside of this, especially work and family life, whatever that constellation could be for them. All right, so to study this, I am focusing on two case studies, empirical case studies initially, both of which has not yet been given any scholarly attention, at least that I have been able to find, although they're incredibly interesting. The first is in 1988, in the summer of 1988, there was a lesbian bus tour around Norway that I will talk about in a second. And the other one is the Pink Rebels group, or the Rosa Rebeller, which was a sort of direct action, quite anarchist group that existed for a fairly short time, but had quite a lasting impact, at least in some sense. So I'll just give you a little bit of a sense of both these case studies as I'm now sort of embarking on actually doing the project. So the lesbian bus, this is a fantastic photo. Lesbebussen is the Norwegian name for the lesbian bus. So this was a project basically to boost lesbian visibility and also knowledge of lesbians and lesbian politics, taking place in July and August in 1988. So basically a group of lesbians decided to travel by bus across the country for 3 weeks to go on a tour and show everyone who we really are. This is a direct quote from one of the key organizers. So they traveled from July from Oslo in late July, drove around the eastern part of the country first, went back to Oslo to participate in the Nordic Forum meeting at the University of Oslo, where they also handed out questionnaires to ask people, and those I really want to find, so I hope to be able to locate them. They then drove down south, took a detour, went to west, and then back up to the north to Tromsø. So this took about 3 weeks, and they basically stopped in a lot of places and were able to live with local lesbian groups in these places, and also did outreach work to the greater community. They made waffles and cakes and served tea and coffee and so on, and talked to people basically about being lesbian and lesbian visibility. And this was very much a collaborative initiative between lesbians in the national lesbian and gay organization at the time, the feminist group Women's Front, or Kvinnefronten, a sort of feminist organization, and also the Pink Rebels that I will talk about in a moment, but also the local women's feminists and lesbian groups around the country. So this was really a very much an outreach project. But why was there a need for this kind of a visibility stunt in 1988? One of the key organizers at the time, Kjersti Andresen, she was interviewed in one of the lesbian gay magazines at the time, Fritt Fram, where she talked about this. And she said, during this time of the AIDS epidemic, the gay men, or the boys as she calls them, they get all the attention, both positive and negative. Lesbians have become invisible yet again. The national organization has long since decided to prioritize lesbian issues. For this reason, it's necessary to put forward concrete strategies. This bus is one such strategy. And she says further on, the Lesbian Bus Initiative will contribute to strengthening lesbian identity, make us visible, and contest the general impression that we don't exist. And part of the motivation for the bus tour initiative was also to school the general feminist organization, Kvinnefronten, or the Women's Front, and make the organization more friendly to lesbians and also prioritize more lesbian feminist politics vis-a-vis general society. So some of you know that we just had the Oslo Pride Festival in Norway now. Oslo is the capital of Norway. And we had 9 days of a lot of events, and I was very fortunate to speak at one of the senior gatherings, or senior queer gatherings in Oslo, and talk about this lesbian bus initiative. And I was sort of fishing for whether there would be anyone in the crowd who would have been there. And yes, there were, and those who hadn't been there, they knew people who had been there. So I now have a pool of women who were either very crucial organizers or who were more in the periphery of this bus tour initiative, and who have been very interested in speaking to me. Interestingly enough, some of them said to me, but I'm not very political, or I was not very political about it. And I just think that is so interesting as a starting point for really understanding why this clearly had such a boost in at least part of the community. All right, let me say a little bit about the Pink Rebels towards the very end. So this was a group, like I said, it was fairly direct action based. It was quite anarchistic. It existed only for about 5-6 years before it sort of fizzled out. It was established by a small group of women, about 4 women, who hailed back to the Red Youth Party, so a very sort of a socialist, quite radical political party. Other members, some men and some women, were also part of the anarchist Blitz movement in Oslo, which exists to this day and is very anarchist. The Pink Rebels was an egalitarian group. There was no real leadership. There was like a steering group of 7 people. The membership was at its largest about 80 people. It consisted mainly of younger and quite radical people, many women, And they were quite fed up with the bigger and more established organizations, especially the DNF, the DNF 48, and then later the LL Roi, for being more conservative, both in their political priorities, but also the way they strategized, or their sort of political tactics vis-à-vis the government. They thought they were too soft on the government, weren't sort of confrontational enough. And also they criticized the national organization for not paying sufficient attention to those coming out, whether they were the youngest people or whether they were older people coming out and into the movement, that basically people, the movement needed to take better care of the newcomers, and that they didn't do so. So they provided a variety of activities. There was a choir, there was the direct action group, more political, there was an information group, there was arts, there was literature groups, there was sort of a lot of things happening. But perhaps the most important part of their work was to be planning and executing direct actions publicly in the streets and also outside the Norwegian parliament or Storting in Oslo. And they were very visible during the Pride parades, often with political slogans that were very radical for Norway. Some of the examples are here. They have a lot of sort of back history, so I don't have time for that now, but it's very interesting to look at this. They had a lot of followers, and many people were sympathetic, but also many in the gay and lesbian movement were very critical to what they perceived to be them to be too radical and anti-democratic tactics, taking hostile sort of the good politicians in the parliament or the mainstream gay and lesbian organization, and they were threatened, or the more sort of respectable parts of the movement argued that the younger people in the Pink Rebels were basically risking the entire movement's respectability and the mainstream support by acting like this outside in the street. What I find interesting about Pink Rebels, and which is sort of part of my line of inquiry, is that they existed at the same time as the notion on politics of queer surfaced and became more prominent in our communities in Norway, as of course many other places. For example, from the early 90s in Norway, the sort of earlier sort of Stonewall commemoration events took the name Skeive Dager, or Queer Days in English, as just one example of this. And increasingly, the older identity categories within the sort of movement of lesbian gay were being contested, as were also the heteronormative ideals of general society, such as monogamy and marriage, by at least some people within the LGBT communities. At the same time, as some of you know, in 1993, we actually passed an equal partnership law in Norway. So a lot of interesting things happened at this time. 1993 was also the year that Pink Rebels really fizzled out. I haven't been able to find that something else happened since, in terms of a more radical organization in Norway, similar to Pink Rebels. There have been some small snippets of action, but not really any sort of organizations that have been able to really establish themselves, or that people haven't been interested in it. So as I see it, and as I will focus on in my continued research, I think that Pink Rebels signified an important transitional practice at this time. They were part of a growing tendency to question older static identity politics located on the lesbian and gay scale. They were concerned with the broader sexual politics, with solidarity practices. They also repeatedly expressed a radical critique of the sweeping heteronormative premise of Norwegian society and culture, including parts of the gay and lesbian movement itself. Their methods were very confrontational, unpredictable, and, as I said, upset many other activists in the national movement at the time. Of course, they also upset the mainstream society and the political establishment. These tensions and how they were experienced by activists at the time, now looking back at this in retrospect, is what interests me in my research to follow. So basically, shortly what I will do, I will continue, or really start, with the actual interviews and focus groups this fall and spring. I will also go to the Queer Archive in Bergen, where they have already documented and conducted a number of interviews with key activists in Norway. I will also stay abroad for a little bit of a while to help analyze my material. And I hope to see you again at the next ARMS conference to tell you more about what I've found. Thank you so much for your attention.
And our final speaker is Dagmar Brunau, now an associate professor of film studies at Linnaeus University in Sweden. Her research centers on archives and audiovisual heritage, cultural memory, documentary filmmaking, as well as feminist and queer experimental filmmaking and video practice. She's also a programmer at the International Queer Film Festival in Hamburg. So while she's speaking, listen, and also think of all the questions you want to ask all four speakers.
Hi, everyone. Can you still stand the heat in here? Good. Okay, so in this panel, we've just heard about visibility, about issues of negotiating self-representation, and about legibility. And these questions will come again in my talk, which will focus on moving images. It's about curating digital content in audiovisual film archives, and it's part of my research project, which I'm about to finalize, which was financed in Sweden, thankfully, by taxpayers' money. And it's called The Cultural Heritage of the Moving Image. And in it, I look at the ways national archives, especially in Sweden, but also in other countries, work with curating access to their digitized collections. And that's one of the specificities. We've so far heard about text-based materials, about journals, but also about still photographs on paper. But film, of course, is another, offers a lot of other challenges for archivists, and queer-related content in these archives is what I'm especially interested in, of course. So one situation, of course, is that the old analog material is currently decaying. It needs to be preserved in proper conditions, in better temperatures than we have in here, cooler temperatures, and so on. And this is not always granted. So that's, of course, a big thing. Then I'm also a memory scholar, and that means I look at the impact that archival practice has on what I call our cultural memory, which now in the third phase of memory studies by now is considered as be a very, is nothing stable. It is considered to be on the move. It's something that is in progress. It's always, well, it's never finalized and never stable. It's always under negotiation. And I'm very influenced by these kind of scholars from the third wave of memory studies, Alison Lunsberg's notion of prosthetic memory, Michael Rothberg's notion of multidirectional memory, how memories are entangled, and Astrid Earle's work, especially her concept of traveling memory, which I have, and I've all of them, I've used all of them, and especially looked at mediated memories, at the notions of a critical notion of what I'm critical about is counter memories, how specific minorities address absences and gaps in the archive, for instance, through their film work. And this is archival practice. And what's part of memory? So what is part of memory, what I call the audiovisual memory, the memories that are circulating in our society at a specific historical time, that is just the top of the iceberg. The rest is forgotten, is about to be forgotten. It may be in the archives, but it's not retrieved. It needs to circulate. It needs to be in motion. And archival practices are also part of this whole process of forgetting. So my argument is that archival practice is not, as it is, as it's always meant to be, a practice of remembrance. It's rather a practice of forgetting, which is quite a depressing notion. So, and archival practice, of course, impacts on what is collected, especially when it comes to film archives. So what is it that national archives collect? And there I would argue they forget to collect a lot of queer-related material. A lot of this material is on video, and video is sometimes not collected by national archives. Cataloging, which we will hear a lot about during these days, metadata, search terms, tagging, what is named and whom is not named, and what about genderqueer positions and fluid identities, how to catalogue those. All of these can lead to forgetting, because the material might be in the archives, but we can't find it, especially not in digitized times, because we don't have any difference anymore between metadata and the original content, because everything is digital. So if we don't have the search terms, we can't find the material. If it's not indexed and tagged, it's also a depressing situation. And then, of course, curating access in these digital times. Very often politicians think that digitization is like the best thing you can do, but is it really? Is that it, or isn't there any more to it? Don't we have to reflect more about these processes of digitization? And what I've been looking at is both the Swedish national site for public, the external window of the Swedish Film Archive, which has some of the digitized collections, which is called filmarkivet.se, mainly documentary films, because the legal and property rights situation is a bit easier. So that's what I've been looking at. And I've been looking at the British Film Institute and the way they look at LGBT plus material. But I've also not only looked at these national archives, because I think there is a lot of expertise lacking in these national archives. We need to take the expertise that we have in what I call the minor archives. You could call them community archives, but they're not always community archives, so that's why I say minor. For instance, Bildwechsel, a legendary archive for a female artist with an immense video collection based in Hamburg and Glasgow and other places. Co-founder Durban is sitting here. And so that is an archive which I've been working with a lot, and which the practice of which has inspired my thinking about all these notions of curation, for instance. And another archive, a project I've been working on is the Lesbian Home Movie Project in Maine, a fairly recent project, and I will come back to some of these examples. In the future, I'm going to work with the Swedish Archive for the Queer Moving Image. We have Anna Linda here, the founder of it, SACMI. So you need to connect, definitely. On a theoretical basis, I'm not only inspired by archival studies and memory studies, but also by critical media studies in Germany. Unfortunately, none of these highly super interesting texts have been translated to English yet, but it's art historian Johanna Schaffer's book, Ambivalenzen der Sichtbarkeit, about the ambivalence of visibility, and it's a fabulous anthology just published recently by Tanya Thomas and many others on recognition, Anerkennung und Sichtbarkeit. And their thoughts have really, really inspired the way I've been thinking about this material and my research project. So recognition is like, who is recognized by whom in the archive and on what grounds? So if an archive wants to recognize lesbians or genderqueer people, how and on what grounds are they recognized? These questions tie very much into what we've heard before. What is the discursive framework which allows people to be seen? And of course, I've been influenced by archival theory, Foucault, Derrida, and Laura Stoller on colonial archives, like the whole notion of the archive as an instrument of power, archiving as a process, not as a neutral activity, but as something that is highly performative. So I look at the agent as look at the archive as an agent in its own right. And because of that, I would think that archiving is not automatic, does not automatically lead to remembrance and to cultural memory. Cultural memory always requires circulation. It requires remediation, and new contexts all the time. So just by putting things in the archive does not mean they're part of our memory. So strategy one, of course, would be to recognize and to make visible. Think if you found this kind of archival footage on 35 millimeters from 1938, an early color film, on a flea market, maybe in Vienna. If you were heteronormative, you would, of course, say, oh, these are two women, they were probably just friends. Of course, they were not just friends. And this is part of the Ruth Storm collection, footage from 1938, which is administered by the Lesbian Home Movie Project in Maine. And here, of course, it already indicates the importance of recognizing what's in the footage, but also the ambivalences. Strategy two would be, of course, to think about the ambivalence of visibility. So if we tag the women in this footage as lesbians, for instance, that would automatically, of course, lead to their vulnerability. And if we then decide to upload this material online, it would even more impact on the vulnerability of these individuals in times of Trump and hate speech and rising right-wing violence. So here I would argue that especially the minor archives, just like Bildwechsel or the Lesbian Home Movie Projects, have the expertise and have the trust of the donors to deal with the material that comes from a time where people had no idea it could be spread out all over the world online to anybody's home, but material that sometimes, as in this case, comes from feminist separatist contexts, like women's music festivals, that this should be handled with care and love and ethical understanding of what we are circulating here. So there is this kind of, I would argue, there's on the one hand, of course, this absolute need of creating an LGBT plus heritage for all of us, but at the same time, on whose costs and what are the problems here. And I've published an article about these issues, especially looking at national archives, in a volume which is online for free, which you can download, and the article is called Naming, Shaming, Framing, Ambivalence of Queer Visibility in Audiovisual Archives. And I will just briefly outline what I've been doing there. I've been looking at the Swedish Film Institute and also at like these kind of rules and regulations that they have, because I mean archivists can't just work freely, free-floatingly in these institutions. They have regulations. And usually for instance, in the UK, you would have like diversity standards saying that, oh, you should take care of Asian Britons and Black Britons, and you should take care of queers, and disability is an issue. The Swedish Film Institute has just rewritten their selection criteria for digitization, and they've actually just come up with this sentence, which I find a paradigm shift, saying that, well, Swedish film history is white and heteronormative. And this is why we have to do something, because we want to widen representation. We need to highlight other narratives. So what they did is, on this website, filmarkivet.se, they started this category, queer. And I haven't done this quiz with you. Usually, sometimes I ask, so what do you think, how many films would be there in a country like Sweden? And everybody would say 150. And here there were 6 to start with. There are some more now, but that's just what you see. And of course, property rights issues are a big thing here. So when asking them, when I looked at that, so I thought, okay, so what is the queer in queer? What does it actually mean? Usually these topics that they have a kind of introduction. At that time, when I was checking it, it didn't have. It now has. I did a workshop with it, with the archivists, and it has changed now, but so I was checking, like, what is the queer in queer? What do they actually mean? Is queer just like LGBT plus and all the other letters? Is queer something else? No idea. So these are, of course, issues to discuss among archivists and to create a kind of image about it. Then I was thinking, okay, if you have a category with 6 films, or maybe even 19 films now, I'm not really sure, saying queer, what about the others, the other several hundred films in the collections? Are they unqueer? Are they not queer? Is there no queer content in these? And, for instance, of course there was footage of Greta Garbo, whom we all know is a queer icon, and there is footage of Selma Lagerlöf, which is the same photo as Ulla's anthology, by the way, and her friend and lover, Sophie Elkan, partner. So what about this footage of Selma Lagerlöf and Greta Garbo not being in this category queer, although it documents really, really well-known queers, and everybody knows this, and those who don't know yet have really slept for many, many decades. Yeah, so naming and metadata management, of course, that is a big issue, whom to tag, how, and how to deal with these new terms in a historical perspective, and so on. The other very important issue I was discussing there is this kind of notion that I've already mentioned, like the notion of shaming from the safe space into cyberspace, footage from separatist or even just feminist events in the 1970s all of a sudden circulating. And then the need, as you also, the other speakers have addressed in this panel, the need to contextualize archival footage. The Lesbian Home Movie Project has this politics when they get stuff, film stock from those who donated, they require either the filmmakers, if they're still alive, or otherwise their friends and their circle, to do oral history interviews with the archivists. So that's a requirement. Otherwise, they don't take it in. They don't add it to their collections. And I really like this approach because it really forces people to conduct oral history interviews and then to use the material for the contextualization later. And just to finish is like what I would rather see, that's one of the insights from my work with these archivists and archives, is like a turn towards being a self-reflexive archive. I mean, archivists and librarians, we all know, are not really what we call in German Rampensäue, like being visible and in the center of attention. But because the decisions have such an impact, I would rather see many of the archival decisions to be documented, either publicly or maybe even documented privately on not published minutes in the archives. But who's writing these texts, the contextualizations? Who has conducted these oral history interviews? Is the text written by an archivist, or is it written by a film scholar who was commissioned for this? All these steps, and if you change like metadata search terms, why have you, and who did it, and who decided, how was the discussion? So that would be, for me as a researcher, it would be really, really interesting to look at that. And I just want to finish with this image of Bill Wechsel's video Pensive, which is, for me, the kind of, it epitomizes the self-reflexive archive, because it's a tent, and inside the tent, a film or a video is digitized. And the audience can sit here and watch the digitized films on the wall of the tent and can also have a conversation with the archivists. The archivists are in the tent, inside the tent, and then you have the conversation of, why did you choose it? What are you doing now? Why do you need to digitize it? So much for that. So that's just a kind of, yeah, as it could be. It's, of course, in this case, it is archival practice as artist practice, and not all archivists and archives can do this, but just, I mean, to open up this utopian space. Thank you.
This should be on too. Oh, yeah.
It is. Okay. Questions?
Thank you very much for this panel. I have a question to Ulla Manns. It's about Ellen Kay, because I agree with your reading of her books. But to me, Ellen Kay is still a paradox, because she didn't live a heterosexual life herself. I have stayed at Strand two summers in the beginning of the 90s. Strand was her house in the middle of Sweden. And there you could read all her books, and you could also see that she had a what's called a proof from a medical doctor that she was still a virgin. So I think it was so complicated, perhaps, life she had. So I think you should also reread or paranoid reading of her life together with her books.
I know. Thank you, Bente. You're not the first one suggesting this to me. I'm still on the Gripenberg side, as you figure out, I guess. But I sometimes fantasize that I would start loving Ellen Kay and start to understand and see behind all these extreme contradictions, because she actually criticized very harshly and very unfairly women that are exactly the same as she is. But she, according to her own narrative, I mean her self-representation, she belonged to the guys. I mean, she belonged to the big guys like Nietzsche and all them, these guys. And still, she was living in that horrible place, Strand. It's a horrible place. If you are to stay there, you have to sign a contract that ensure you the boss, whatever, that you will work in her spirit. So that's why I never applied for going there.
She's picking you.
Hi, thank you all for your presentations. My question was for Elizabeth. I was fascinated by the idea of a lesbian bus. I think we should have more of them. and I know you're just starting your research, but can you tell us a little more about it? I was particularly interested in what the reception was, and if they were in danger in places. If you have any more information that you could share at this particular moment.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I think the Lesbian Bus Project, everybody thinks it's super fascinating, including myself. That's, of course, why I kind of chose it in many ways. I've been reading through the gay and lesbian magazines of that year, at least the main ones, in Oslo, Bergen, and some of the alternative ones, and where there was quite extensive coverage of it before it started and during August, and then there's sort of nothing. I don't find more coverage of the lesbian bus, what happened. I found a little bit, actually, in mainstream newspapers. So, for example, when they came up to Tromsø, the mainstream local newspaper covers sort of what happened in quite favorable language, actually, compared with, I think, the more the sort of internal gay lesbian periodicals language that wrote about the lesbian bus tour before it started. I found it interesting. It was gay male journalists who wrote about this, and they were very Kjersti Andresen, one of the key organizers, she was repeatedly described in very sort of physical terms, and in terms of whether she smiled a lot or whether she was very sort of aggressive and so on. Those kind of representations are quite interesting to me. But no, I haven't found that yet, which was also why I realized I needed to also do a broader sort of ethno-historical project and actually talk to women who participated. So this is kind of information I want to uncover by talking to the women who participated. Thank you.
Just a short comment on that. It's a lesbian bus going on up in the north of Sweden right now. It's a huge project, a lesbian museum touring the whole north of Sweden and writing about lesbian history in the north.
Thank you. I'll find out.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions, I think, one more specific and one more general. The more specific question is to the first speaker. I thought it was really curious, like this juxtaposition of intimacy and like the orgasm on the male side of sexuality. So I thought maybe you can tell us a little bit, or like can explain to me what they mean by orgasm, because that seems really unified. Like, you know, like that seems to be, that's the specific question. And the more general question is, I thought it's really fascinating that in all of the talks there's a notion of, yeah, like visibility coming up, but also like over against the constant invisibilization of lesbians. And I thought of Halberstam in A Queer Time and Place talking about the problem that sometimes part of a certain story is that a part of it is invisible, like that there's sometimes a problem of like a genuine representation of something or somebody being or like including a certain omission. And I mean, he's doing that regarding Brent and Tina and like a trans person. And there the idea is that, of course, he would ask Brent and Tina who Brent and Tina is. Brent and Tina would not say, I'm a transgender man. That's exactly what's not happening in the story. So every narrative that says, this is a transgender man, is actually a misrepresentation, right? So I was wondering like how, like, and I thought there seems to be a similar situation, and I wanted to put the question to all of you, like how you deal with this hinge of your work, or if that even matters. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll start quickly with the orgasm question. So I was interested to see how did they write about, frame desires and sex or sexuality. And what I found was that they had a really hard time, or they did not feel that they had a language to talk about sex. And orgasm is mentioned, for example, in a poem, and there it's mentioned as the impossible word. So just to say the word, it felt impossible. And then I link orgasm to the genital sex part, which is kind of absent from the journals. And then, of course, my argument is disappeared. sorry about that. That there were many reasons for why it was so hard for them to write about genital sex or sexuality, and many of the reasons were, I mean, to kind of remove homosexuality from the dirty, sleazy parts, to make it more sanitized for the straight feminists at the time, and also personal reasons. They found it really embarrassing and really hard. I mean, they were really young, coming to the big city to be lesbians, and they wanted to have lesbian sex, but they hadn't read about it. So anyway, so orgasm was difficult, and then they focused on authenticity and intimacy instead. And then to the broader question, who wants to start? Adama?
Thanks. That's a very important point that you made there. I would again call it the ambivalence of visibility, like Brendan Tina, that this kind of tagging someone, and which goes totally beyond or on counter to self-representation. I would again mention Bildwechsel, because Bildwechselism is a very interesting archive which is not so obsessed about this tagging and naming as maybe official archives might be. And so which in a very interesting way plays out this kind of discrepancy, or this interesting paradox of, on the one hand, being situated in a queer feminist context, but not all the time like tagging everything as this and this and this and this. As Virginia Woolf said, it's not about this and that. And again, this shows that will be an example of an archive which paves the way and shows how it could work for other archives as well. On the other hand, these official archives have this kind of political impetus of like creating a heritage for, especially in Sweden, for the whole society, and why should LGBTs be excluded there? But then how to work with this notion of inclusion, which is such a highly problematic inclusion anyway, as we know, as diversity, because it always there is so much essentialism in all these notions. So in that sense, I find it really inspiring. That's why I find your question so good. And Jack has been thinking this through very, very well.
Okay, it's a huge question, and as I said in my presentation, I haven't quite got to the crunch of my project yet, but one of the ways in which I think about this question of visibility and why I wanted sort of in my bigger project women's justice politics to be sort of the center of attention in this was really to figure out in sort of in retrospect then what it was like for the women who participated in at least two types of groups or activities at the time. What did lesbian mean to them? Was it like an identity term? Was it something you did? Was it something, or is it something they still adhere to? What does it mean for a woman to be part of, say, the lesbian bus? Does it mean something else for them now when they look back, for example? And use that as a starting point for trying to understand what sort of the politics of lesbian visibility was at the time for a great diversity of women. But I think also it's important today in 2019 where sort of the word lesbian is sort of gone for the younger generations in many ways and where, at least in Norway, there is increasing discussion around lesbian invisibility yet again, at least for a certain demography of lesbians who feel that they are being excluded or made invisible by queer women and by other kinds of lesbians, for example. So I think that there's a sort of history project or also for the present in looking at these kinds of ways. But so that is a way that I'm trying to understand what this can all mean. Not a good answer, but yeah.
I think this might be more of a comment than a question to Ulla Mans. I thought it was really fascinating that you picked up Alexandra Gripenberg as somebody who was opposing this women's motherhood, because I think in Finland it's often sort of the early women's movement in its totally is often conflated with this idea that like this societal motherhood kind of, which was used as an argument for women, for example, to go into politics because they could then take care of the motherly things there. And Alexandra Gripenberg, she was the chairperson of a women's organization in Finland, and the vice chairperson of that same organization was Hilda Käkikoski, who was an unmarried woman who was living together with another woman. And when they started, that relationship started to fall apart and they broke up, Hilda Käkikoski wrote a letter to Alexandra Gripenberg where she was sort of delicately trying to explain why they fell apart. And I never found that letter in Alexandra Gripenberg's archive. So I don't know whether that was a draft that was never sent or whether Alexandra Gripenberg like destroyed it or whatever. But it seemed for me that it was really difficult for Hilda sort of to be open about that relationship to Alexandra, yeah. Which also might be because she was a baroness and Hilda came from kind of a working class background from the countryside, mm-hmm. although she later on became a teacher. And one of the first MPs in Finland.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your comment, Tula. Yeah, Alexandra Gripenberg is very interesting as a person, and one of the articles in the book I showed you is about Alexandra Gripenberg and Topelius. I now I forgot her first name. Sakari Astopieli's daughter, anyway. They were very close friends. Sorry? Toini, thank you, thank you. But also when it comes to Alexandra Gripenberg as a feminist, the historiography of early feminism is very, sometimes we can't see that it's quite a shift from very early organized feminism. And then when the whole fight for suffrage around the turn of the 20th century starts, things happen. It's an ideological shift. They go strongly towards motherhood rhetoric because it's so much easier to argue for the rights for woman suffrage in terms of of motherhood rhetoric. And the interesting thing with these three-volume monograph I've been analyzing is that the first volume is from 1898 and the last is from 1903. So it's actually pre-suffrage for the Nordic countries anyway when it comes to the organized fight for women's suffrage. So it's really fascinating to work with, and she is also a fascinating person. But in my when I worked with a monograph, I have been very careful to say or show the reader that this is about how it could have been read. It's not about her as an author. But thank you so much for commenting, because she's very under-investigated, I guess. So thank you.
And I'm going to close this exactly on time, and thank you all for coming and ask you to think. Oh, an urgent question?
I just had a question for Bruno? Sorry. You did a lot of really interesting, you all did a lot of really interesting research, but you brought up a lot of questions and points about how to deal with certain things in community archives and digitizing. And I was just wondering if you came away with some really staunch beliefs about how to deal with things like that, because I work in an archive where we have a relationship with a big university, and they will publish a photo from our archive of a woman topless, and then we know that woman. And then she will come to us and say, you need to do something about this. And so we advocate for her and get like that picture taken off the web. And then I've even, as a photographer, put a T-shirt on a woman who's requested that we either pull the photo off or do something else. So I was just wondering, if you have some really strong opinions about methods or best practices.
Because I'm studying the Lesbian Home Movie Project, they have constantly these issues, and I mean there is no rule, and there is this kind of ethical challenge, but there is of course nobody who actually decides which is right and wrong. And what I found really interesting is that because I'm so socialized within the Bildwechsel way of archiving, which is more like, oh no, if there is a topless photo, we would never put it online, and we will not put things online where we know people, because it's almost like getting love letters, because it's such a matter of trust to preserve this material from our community that we just don't want it to float around. And the Lesbian Home Movie Project is more, rather would like to upload things online, but then there was this discussion about a topless woman at a music festival, and the archivist, who's rather sex positive, actually says, well, it will be a great idea, and then during the Facebook discussion, some of the other testimonial witnesses of the time, some from that generation, also said, yeah, it should be uploaded because we need to show the fuckers that the way we looked and our boobs are beautiful no matter what they look like, and there's no silicone in them. And then others said, no, it can be used as pornography. So there was quite a debate. I mean, but it wasn't this kind of hostile debate. It was a very like, oh, this is our past, so what is our responsibility towards that? And so I think the best practice example would not be to say this is right or that, but the best practice is a practice that has been thought through and where you can see where actually archivists have taken a decision that is grounded in always in collaboration with the donors and with the property rights owners and with the filmmakers and the people in the footage, of course, as you did. So that was the signal for the coffee break.
Super. Now let's thank the speakers.